part of our strategy was spending a lot of time saying no. No to really fantastic opportunities that represented a lot of financial growth for us. We said no. There's quick money and there's being smart.
Hey everybody, I'm Christian Schoff. Welcome to the Life Uncharted podcast. Each week we sit down with extraordinary people who have stuck their nose in the wind, stepped off the beaten path, and forged their own path to success. What made them do it? How did they succeed? And how can we follow in their groundbreaking footsteps? You're about to find out right now. Hey guys, what's happening? Christian here. This week we interview my good friend Ryan Hauser. Ryan and I met while I was living in Southern California. We literally were randomly paired up on a team at the Camp Pendleton Mud Run. We shook hands, the gun went off, and for the next few hours, we suffered alongside each other and our other two teammates. Since then, both of our lives have changed dramatically, but we've been able to stay in touch. And while I moved from OC to PC, Ryan made the move from OC to Boise. Kindred spirits, I guess you'd say. So what's Ryan's story? Ryan's the founder of Paul Frank, a wildly popular brand in the late 90s and early 2000s. You may remember the iconic monkey logo on shirts, ties, and all sorts of accessories. After selling Paul Frank, Ryan started another company, a super cool athletic clothing brand called Athletic Recon, and now hosts the Brevity Code podcast, which, if you like The Life Uncharted, you should definitely check out. Ryan is an entrepreneur with a keen eye for cool and just a great all-around guy. I know you'll enjoy this one. Here we go. Okay, Ryan, welcome to the Life Uncharted podcast.
Happy to be here, man.
We're dropping in after hanging out for about 20 hours. So it's not like you just walked into the room. We've been working on some stuff.
Yes, but this is mid-stride conversation.
Right. Like, but welcome to Park City. You're living in Boise now, right?
Yeah, just outside. A little farming community called Eagle.
Eagle.
Yeah.
I cannot wait to get into this because I think this is such a cool story. I told you, like, I think you tagged your wife in a picture and then I clicked on her thing and saw she had a blog and started reading the blog and I literally got teary-eyed reading it. So I want to talk about why, but I always like to start by asking people, who are you? I don't like to say it. I like you to say it to make sure it's most accurate and most current. And so who's Ryan Hauser?
Yeah, I think Ryan Hauser has, it's certainly a work in progress. If you had asked me this question, I think even as much as a year ago, you might have got an entirely different type of answer. I a long time California, born and raised, and had a couple business startups there. And now I find myself with an entirely new set of challenges. Moving my family out of state to Idaho. And so I think I'm someone that, looks to get uncomfortable. And I always have this kind of, one of my little daily mantras is, sort of nothing good happens when you're comfortable. And,
amen.
And although that's a hard road, it is the path that I am drawn towards. So I think that there's a bit of a challenge seeker mentality there. And I'm always seeking newness. And again, which goes back to nothing good happens when you're comfortable. You just, I want to continue to evolve and grow and learn and experience new things. And felt like the point where I was prior, that had stalled out.
Mm-hmm. Which is easy to do given your life trajectory, I would say.
Yeah.
So let's get into that a little bit. First of all, how we met. If I'm right, we met at the Camp Pendleton Mud Run?
We did, yes.
That's so right. We basically met in a parking lot at a grocery store. We all got together.
Yeah.
We drove to Camp Pendleton. And like I got dropped into your team. Yeah, I don't even know how I got sucked into that, to be honest.
Yes, that's right. Right. There was several of us. Was it like you were with
Tom Davin, the guys from 5'11",
yeah.
And Willem actually was there.
Okay.
Then
I've met him before.
You have.
Okay.
I just connected on that.
Right.
He should be here in an hour.
Right.
But we drove down. And as I remember, the gun went off and we were just kind of standing around. And we probably ran past the start line a couple minutes after the first people did. And didn't we end up in like
fourth place or
something? I think we did pretty good in the team result. Yeah.
We were dropping the hammer.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Yeah. At least our revisionist history would suggest.
Actually, we won. That, no.
Yeah. We did quite well.
But those are pretty bonding experiences. We got to be buddies.
Yeah.
You were doing triathlon stuff. You know, I kind of was dabbling a bit. We did some bike rides. We did some stuff with your brand at the company I was working for at the time, but I've known you for probably 4 or 5 years now, I guess. Yeah. And,
always been a fan of yours.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that. And me too. So when I met you, you had a company called Athletic Recon, and I just remember, you like showing up that day and you had that stuff on, and a guy that worked for me was like, "Oh, I love that brand." And then you said, "Oh, I started this brand." I was like, "Oh, wow, this is really cool." So when I dove into who you were and stuff, the backstory is Paul Frank. And that's where you really made your first big mark.
Yeah.
But can you, so you were the founder.
Yes.
With two business partners?
Yes. It originally started out of my garage in Huntington Beach, California, in late November 95. And so my partner, early on was Paul Frank Sonich. So we chose his first and middle name as the name of the company, as we wanted the company to evolve and never be pigeonholed by the name, but to whether we had a grand scheme to make house paints and to make all these kind of quirky items. So we figured, and at the time it was kind of apropos, like you know, Calvin Klein, Laura Ashley, gosh, there was another one too, like sort of these, like these first name
Massimo
kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, like two first names.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And Paul Frank. And we were like, huh? Yeah, works. So we set up shop in my garage and,
where did the original idea come from? Or what was the concept? Like, you're like, we're going to start this business.
So I was attending university, in Southern California, and I went to Chapman, and I was taking study breaks, downtown Huntington Beach, which has transformed into something completely different these days. But back then it was a pretty quaint little beach city. And there was a little newsstand, and I'd go grab a coffee and roll over to the newsstand and like just kind of do like a little study break, go over, grab a magazine. And Paul was working at the newsstand at the time. And I've always been someone who's been into, you know, fashion to a certain extent. And, you know, didn't really know what I even wanted. I was a totally undecided major forever. I was always drawn to fashion and music. And I always thought like, but that's silly. How do you make a career out of that? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that was like a real job. I mean, I knew there was design school and all that, but how did you make a job out of that? Anyway, so Paul commented on some jeans I was wearing that I had got at a thrift shop, you know, mostly because I couldn't really afford anything else.
So he thought you were fashionable, but you were just college.
Yeah, totally. And so we started talking, and one thing led to another. And, you know, I was reading some magazines that he had similar tastes for, and he said, "Oh, you should check this one out." And pretty soon we became friends, kind of in an acquaintance way, where I know where you work and I go there and we see each other.
Yeah.
He was also, he's an excellent guitar player. He was playing in a band, and turns out my band was totally crappy, but we ended up on the same bill a couple times. So then now we've kind of got this music connection. So now we've kind of got this full creative vein happening. And, you know, and so one day he says, "Hey, I want to show you something." And he pulls out this shoebox. And in the shoebox is random materials of scrap vinyl and different color threads and different snaps. And he says, "I want to make you a wallet." And I just thought, like, that is the weirdest thing that I have ever heard. But I'm so into it. And you're so endearing.
Yeah,
I'm in. Of course. Yeah. So I picked out my stuff. And he said, "Okay, I'll have it for you in a week." And I thought, okay, cool. And come back. And sure enough, he's like, "Oh, I have your wallet for you." And I tried to give him $10, like, you know,
right
here, you know, something for the effort. And he's like, "No, I made this for you because you're my friend." And that moment, that was one of those moments where you look at a guy and you go, "You're rad," and like you're not expecting anything in return. And then all those other things start to come into play. Like, here's a guy who went home, took his time with no expectation of payment, and wanted to do something genuine for someone else. Mm-hmm. And that's a special thing. And that always kind of stuck with me because that's just not how our society works.
Totally.
And those communications continued to evolve, and he began showing me, hey, I made this purse for my girlfriend, which was actually the catalyst for how the company got started.
The purse was.
Yes. So we're at coffee another time, and he puts this red purse, it was called the teacup style. And he said, what do you think? And I said, well, I think it's great. You know, like, where did you buy it? And he's like, no, I made it. And I was like, wow. And that purse was beyond a wallet. He would have to have had knowledge of pattern and construction. And using vinyl is an unforgiving material, because once you make punch holes in vinyl, it's sort of a lasting hole. You can't go backwards. And it was at that very moment, sitting in that coffee shop, I turned to him and I was like, let's start a company. Like, what does that mean? I don't know what that means. And, and he kind of, you know, gripped his coffee cup and brought it into his chest. And he was like, yeah, okay. Because now I think, like, in a way, like, I validated him. Like, I'm telling you, hey man, I feel like you're so crazy talented. I want to invest my time and I believe in you. And he was working at a newspaper stand. He's just a random guy.
That's interesting, because in a way, like, he did something for you and then you were doing something back with what you do. But the other thing I hear is, like, this was a guy that wasn't really worried about commerce, and then it was starting a business. Like, was he, did he have hesitations around that because he was just an artiste that was like, I don't know if I want to monetize this. It's just my thing.
Yeah. That's a really good angle. And perspective. I think initially, yes, it was very pure, and it was, and he approached it the same way, like, oh, you mean you can actually help me get this product out there into more people's hands? Not for the commerce side of it at all. Like, this was not a guy who was money motivated.
He just wanted to share his art.
He wanted to share his art. Now, there came a time in the business when it became more than an art project, and it changed the dynamic. And I don't think he liked it very much. Mm. And I think that was a really hard thing, where you'd have a big, we won't name names on the accounts, but a big major department store coming in saying, we love your product, but we want it in this color, and we know you're offering this color. Ah. And I would say, well, that's a gigantic order. You're a great premium retailer. We'll do it, because I still think it's within the brand parameters. And I would take it to Paul and I'd say, hey, this is what's going to happen. And he'd be like beside himself. Like, we can't do that. And like, well, if we want to grow this thing, we could. But I don't think Paul ever really thought about growing this thing. That was me putting, like, hey, sure, we have something real.
That's
here.
Really interesting.
You know, and that was a really, and hey, look, partnerships are hard. But part of that push and pull is what makes the beauty, you know? Those were often internal struggles that we faced. And eventually in 2006, I think it was, it's a distant memory now, but you know, we had 100 employees by that time. And you know, that situation, that rubber band snapped, and he wanted to get off the train. Mm-hmm. And, because I think he wanted to return back to art and didn't like where the company was going. And it was, I think all of us, to a certain extent, the company was global. We sold in 65 countries.
How long did it take you to get to that level?
Yeah, I kind of skipped a big section there, didn't I?
You know it inherently, so I think in your brain it's all, but I don't know this.
Your question was?
How long did it take you to scale to said 100 employees in 60-some countries?
So again, from those really early inception meetings, you know, in late 95, 96 was still a very formative year, even into 97.
I was my junior year in high school there.
Okay.
Dang.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. Yeah, I know, man. So,
we're only a few years apart.
Yeah. 98 was really the jumping off point, and it was a rocket ship. And so, yeah, 98 to by 2006, for example, we were probably close to 100 employees.
It was like 10 years.
Something like that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Maybe just under. So distribution in 65 countries, 30 freestanding retail stores, 1,200 accounts, global rep force, formidable brand doing collaborations with, we were the first. Quick brag session here. So it's my favorite thing.
I like it. I like it. So.
We were the first brand that Sanrio Hello Kitty character was ever associated with outside of their own brand. So that means we like beat out Mickey Mouse and some pretty heavies in the space,
right,
to get to Hello Kitty first. But, you know, John Deere and Elvis Presley and Vans and Procheds and... gosh, I'm forgetting tons of other ones, but just...
These were collaborations you had.
Yeah.
John Deere,
an ag company, yeah. But they're smart because they knew that we represented the demographics of a new generation and a very hip...
So what was that product?
We did full line. So polo shirts, belt buckles, accessories. We went deep into their archives and pulled up some of their old tractors, like some of the initial stuff. And we would make like, you know, single color silk screens and put them on t-shirts and bags in a more unexpected way that you might experience John Deere than the traditional, you know. Yeah. And by the way, at the same time, Ashton Kutcher's on Pumped wearing the John Deere cap. Our thing pops like it was a perfect storm for that to happen. And there was this brilliant flash of, you know, pop culture relevance for John Deere.
Totally.
Yeah. But totally random, right? And that was the fun. That was the juice of the whole thing. Like, what business do we have doing a collaboration with John Deere? And it's in those unexpected things you get to solve that creative riddle.
So just to drill into the John Deere thing, how did that come about? Did they reach out to you?
Did you
reach out to them?
We reached out to them. We had a couple guys, our creative director at the time and our head of ops, you know, in conjunction with our marketing team, put together deck, flew to Moline, mm-hmm. and sold them a dream. I did not go on that one. I was got to be involved in it once it was sort of brought to the table. But right. So we went to them, and again, to their credit, they understood the importance of marketing to the next gen, I think, in an unexpected way. With a new and fresh perspective.
So Paul was the original artist, let's call it.
Yeah.
As you start doing all these collaborations and stuff, you are, obviously he's not doing all of that.
Oh yeah. No.
Then is he a guy that rolled into a role where he's yang and naying other artists that are basically trying to understand his brain and creating stuff? Or how do you scale that when it's, because like, as an example, I have a friend that's an artist and she had an opportunity to get into like Urban Outfitters, but she's painting everything by hand. So how do you scale that and keep the cool?
Yeah, that's part of the trick. I mean, we definitely had, you know, he drove the creative side of things, and to anticipate what was going to come out of his brain next, it was impossible. I mean, he's very sort of Andy Warhol-ish, where we actually set up a studio outside of the walls of our building, and we set up silk screens and a woodworking section and drafting tables and sewing stations.
It's like Skunk Works.
And he would like wake up and whatever would manifest, he might make a piece of furniture. And then it was kind of up to me and the rest of the designers and the merchandising teams to figure out how do we fit this into our line? And therein lies the challenge. And then we did have some, at the time, just some great artists that made themselves known to us, came up, that really did think in a similar vein to mm-hmm. Paul. So we did have sort of right and left hands to complement. He might have said, oh, I'm thinking, and he would do this. He'd be like, it's all about llamas right now. And I'm like, llamas, okay.
Yeah.
And then the artist would sit there and we would, and sometimes he would have, you know, examples of, hey, I want this kind of llama, not that one. I mean, that really happened.
More an alpaca.
Yeah, yeah, right.
If
right.
you will.
Right. So, we brought in some really great people to surround him, really foster that. And then it was really kind of ultimately up to me to work in between the creative team and the sales team to say, is this a viable product? Can we sell this? Is it on brand? Where does it fit? How do we price it? And kind of play that game, which was a really fun thing to do. It was always new.
Wow. So I think a lot of people that are thinking about starting companies or start companies listen to this podcast, from what I've gathered. Any words of advice from that experience that, like, was there any special sauce? Was there anything that, looking back, was like, man, that really made a difference? Or was this just lightning in a bottle and you wrote it?
Here's what I could say. Yeah. So I think we definitely had lightning in a bottle, you know, all those things you hear about: luck, timing, economic conditions. One of the things I maybe credit us for succeeding in is there are a lot of companies that are flash in the pans where maybe they're onto something. I'll just name names here because it is what it is.
Yeah.
Von Dutch.
Right.
You saw Von Dutch. They sold an ungodly amount of hats and t-shirts. And then where is Von Dutch?
Mm-hmm.
And they were a quick kind of in and out. And I don't, no disrespect, they made a ton of money, and maybe their business model and objectives were completely different than ours. So mm-hmm. I'm not here to judge them, but I am here to say that they executed one type of business model, and ours was about longevity and integrity and building products that were fun and quirky and compelling. And so we spent, part of our strategy was spending a lot of time saying no, whether that's no to really fantastic opportunities that represented a lot of financial growth for us. We said no. As we were talking about at dinner last
night.
That's
a hard thing to do when you're starting and money's tight and there's opportunity on the table.
Yeah, but what is dilutive, right? There's quick money and there's being smart. And we just knew, like, hey, and again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier. Like, Paul was not money driven and I wasn't necessarily, I was in business to make money, but we wanted to be genuine.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really use that as sort of the guiding principle, I think more times than not, you're going to make the right decision. So I think to our credit, we did really limit our growth and we were able to last a lot longer than I think a lot of people predicted.
It sounds like you said genuine, but I hear authenticity, I guess. You stayed authentic to who Paul was. I mean, that's something we talk about with our brand and with everything. It's like, I feel like people can sniff out a fraud pretty quickly.
For sure. For sure.
So, wow. So 10 years in, you guys exited the company.
In 2010.
2010 you did. Anything you want to, again, I don't know how much of that is like secret or undisclosed or whatever, but you know, like, what was your decision to get out and why was that the right time? And, you know, can you talk on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I think so. As much as we rode a solid economic wave up, you know, 2008 hits and the world changes and, you know, retail gets a bit, you know, get some blowback there. Stores are closing. We had had the lawsuit with Paul leaving the company, so some bad press that had marred us through prior years. And the business was, I think again, it turned into something that no one really anticipated. And there was some missteps along the way, of course. And for me, I was ready to just go do something else and transition out. And I look back and just think, like, what a crazy charmed experience that was. And
right.
But time to, you know, pack in and go do something else.
Well, and we were talking about this a little bit yesterday. I think the entrepreneurial business is very different than a business with 100 employees. Like, what I think about a lot is I'm trying to build a team of a small team that's really good versus a large headcount of B players. And I just think when you start to get into 100 employees, no matter what, you're kind of dealing with human issues, with all the things that you probably were trying to avoid when you started the company.
Yeah. Things like lawsuits, people suing you for no reason, like the frivolous, I mean, you have to spend money to fight those, counterfeiting. like, yeah, there are like these things that are awful about business, and they're like, you really see the bad in people, and they really start to pull you into places and deviate focus.
Right. Right.
That have no bearing on your business, but you know, you got to protect your IP. You got to protect your house. You got to go do factory raids, and you got
to, and you just want to make rad
stuff. Right.
And hang out with your friends and work out of a garage and make some money.
Totally, man.
And now you're like dealing with HR issues and lawsuits.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunately the general trend of a successful business.
Yeah. Right.
Which is probably why, you know, they always talk about the founder CEO. I was listening to a podcast where they're talking to Nick Woodman from GoPro, and that's almost a derogatory term because founders usually aren't good CEOs because CEOs are very number driven, very analytical. Founders are a little more mad scientist, Willy Wonka's. And to find a guy that can transition is pretty rare.
Yeah.
Even I would say find a guy that wants to transition is even rarer. I don't know. I think that's interesting. I think about that a lot, right? It's like, you know, we work out of my house, and while it's like, sounds really fun to have a big office, part of me is like, do not overlook how good you have it right now to like have a dog hanging out, and it's casual and we get our work done, and it's life.
Yeah. That's good perspective. I mean, I think, I spent a lot, we opened up a store in South Coast Plaza. That's a premier mall in Orange County.
Yeah.
And I used to shop there as a little kid, you know, with my mom, and we're opening up this store in South Coast Plaza. It was a premier night. And, you know, I was largely in charge of every aspect of that, from the press that was going to show up to what kind of food we were serving to, you know, is everything right, to staffing it, to working with the architect along the way. And I was blinded by the amount of work and pressure that I had. And I had this moment where I was standing there with my mom on the outside of the store, and she turned to me and she's like, "Are you proud of yourself?" And I was like, "What do you mean? I have to go back in there in a minute, Mom. The LA Times is showing up." And she's like, "You did this." And I was like, whoa. Like, that moment was my gravity moment where I was like, whoa.
You can overlook the success you've had, or the progress you've made. Because there's just always another battle, right?
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah. And so, like, I wish I would have, like what you just said, like, you got your dog hanging out, you work with your friends here. Like, I think I lost a lot of that quickly. Mm-hmm. So certainly to anyone out there that's on that, you know.
But how old are you at that time? How old are you?
I'm thinking I'm probably 30.
30. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm 38. So 38, you probably, if you were in that same spot, you probably had a different perspective.
A little more perspective. Yeah.
So you're a kid.
Yeah.
That's a big moment at 30.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
But you take it all in stride. Like, cause you know, we never wrote a business plan, and we never like, okay, you know, year six, we're going to have a store at South Coast Plaza. Like we never mapped it out like that.
Right.
And at some point, of course, you get structure and you form a board and you forecast like that. But I would have laughed at you if you would have said, you know, you're going to sell, you know, to the premier shops in Japan. And this, it just grew like the way it was supposed to.
You know? Does that work today?
The world has the shift now to launch an apparel company, and with some of the online presence of the beasts that are out there, and the lack of brick and mortar support, and I think there's success stories, but I think it's way harder. Mm-hmm. It's way harder.
Which probably leads to your next endeavor, which was Athletic Recon, which is when I met you.
Yeah.
And I'll just say, like, it's still my favorite stuff to wear. Ugh. And the stuff I have is probably five, like, Who listening has a pair of gym shorts that are 5 years old that still prefer to put those on? I mean, this was really good stuff.
Thanks,
doesn't
man.
Smell 5 years later.
Yeah.
Still holds together. I think I had one pair where a seam blew out. Otherwise, they've all been rocking. Like,
it's good to hear.
It was good stuff. And it was, how would you describe that brand for somebody that doesn't know it?
So we were definitely, you know, so growing up, you know, looking at, I know everyone's on the tip of Navy SEALs these days. And I don't want to say I was there a long time prior, but like, I was reading the Navy SEAL handbook. I downloaded it. Like the workout styles of the Navy SEALs are like, there's like a guideline. And those were largely guys that inspired me trying to, you know, be the best athlete I could be and the best person I could be. And so we really modeled the Literal was to really sort of be the best, most premier athletic focused brand out there. Which is just crazy. If you think I'm going up against, Nike and Adidas, Under Armour was just coming on, and Lululemon had men's. And that was, so you're talking, you know, just industry giants. Yeah. And I thought like, well, but I can come along with this like really hardcore brand, you know, where we were dressing some of the top CrossFitters in the nation. Mm-hmm. And again, to, you know, special operations guys and law enforcement, and really like having those guys put that stuff to the test. So that was, I really wanted to kind of be the gold standard. And then I really wanted, like, I looked at Lululemon and I was like, God, what dude would wear his wife's workout clothes? Like, I just don't get it. Like, they make great stuff. Their materials are superior, and they're, it's beautiful. And obviously, you know, they're a massive. That was an issue. but I really just wanted to be the gold standard of, you know, we were the alternate. If you didn't want to wear mass brands to the gym and you wanted a bit of individuality, mm-hmm. and to set yourself apart, you know, you could wear like, you know, our blacked out camos. Like, we really made some pretty stealthy stuff.
Yeah.
And then the plan was go and sell it into the best boutiques and men's shops and sport performance stores and CrossFit boxes. So we really had a neat distribution plan. And while I think we executed largely successfully on the product, we may have been a little early to the party.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how you compete with those giants. I mean, if your product's 20% better, it still doesn't matter.
No.
Or 100% better. I just, man. That's scary. Like, when I started Uncharted, I looked for a space where there was no competition. I mean, that's how sensitive I am to like trying to go down that path. So, man, I still I think I heard Brian McKenzie say that too in your podcast, where he's like, still my favorite shorts, you know, it's good stuff. And do you think we'll ever see it come back to life or no?
I would not rule it out, because I still have a strong passion for it. I'm still super into training, mm-hmm. and I still see the void, although there's a couple of newer brands that have entered the space. They're doing a really nice job.
And they look a lot like you, I would say.
Yes, maybe, perhaps. Yes. but they also have their own niche and their own angle on things. And again, credit to them. I would never say never on that, because it would be fun. It'd be fun to dust it off. And I think there'd be a certain interest in those that were circling on the brand that would find it. And I would hope it go much wider than that this time.
Right. Right. So how long did you work on that one? And I hate to bring up disappointing moments, but can you tell me when you decided like, I got to stop?
Yeah.
You know, like it's not catching on at the rate I need it to. I mean, it's not that you weren't selling, were. It's just when you look at advertising and marketing and new, I mean, you were talking about how many SKUs you have. Like, we've got, you know, like Tracy said earlier, you can count them on two hands. Yeah. You had what, four or five sizes for every brand, every shirt.
Yeah.
And there's 20 shirts and
multiple colorways. Yeah. Hundreds of SKUs. And it's essentially a startup company. So
that's a lot of overhead.
So I think, you know, when you have a success like a Paul Frank size and it goes mm-hmm. global and everything you do, it more or less works, you get a little bit of an ego, like, hey, I could take on Nike and Adidas. I could do this. And I think, you know, a certain amount of ego is good when you're faced with the kind of adversity that a startup can be.
I mean, entrepreneurs are, what's the quote about, like, if you actually knew how hard it was going to be, you'd never start.
Totally.
So ignorance is kind of bliss when you're in that position.
No, 100%. So, so we had done the placement strategy worked, you know, we were in every store that I identified in the business plan, which we did write this time, which again is sort of ironic, because you don't write the business plan, smashing success. I do write the business plan. I have, you know, 15 years of apparel knowledge and contacts and all this resource, and it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And I think going in, I thought like, well, of course this is going to work. This is going to be my next thing and it's going to work. You know, but putting a measure on, I do think it worked to a certain extent. I just think it was not the right time. And, you know, it's just unfortunate, because it was rad stuff. So yeah. So when did we close it? So I think the decision was made, we were at an order deadline in our business, where it's basically you are receiving your orders from your sales reps out there in the accounts, and you have to do what we call, you know, sort of you punt on your inventory, which is where you have to buy off on a certain amount of unsold goods. And, you know, the numbers were not looking good. And I just sat there and I think sometimes the hardest decisions, you know, you got to put the ego aside and just go, this isn't going to work. And you got to look yourself in the mirror and know when to say when. And I think I could have saved face and continued to play this game like, oh yeah, everything's cool, and continue to hemorrhage cash. Mm-hmm. And so I think the humble approach was to shut it down, you know?
That's an interesting moment, because we've had our back against the wall a couple times, and the instinct is to fight through it, right? To just, and I feel like every time you read a success story, those people had those moments, whether it's Phil Knight, you know, if you read the Shoe Dog book,
oh, yeah, great book,
or Losing My Virginity, you know, Richard Branson, it's like, there were moments where they were like on their last breath. But there's also, to your point, like a moment where you stop throwing good money after bad money and go, man, I'm going to really put myself in a bad position if I keep doubling down on this.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a hard moment. I don't know how you know when is when.
Yeah. I mean, we had a strategic partner in China that, so we really had the supply chain sewn up, and it was beautiful. But I felt out of obligation and full transparency to that gentleman who believed in our company, put in money and was making the product, that, hey man, this, we're not hitting our numbers. This is not growing to the extent we need it to grow. And you're putting a lot of time and resource this wasn't just about being cured with initial investment and initial funding. This was, why aren't we, you know, seeing the growth that we need to see? And I wasn't convinced it was going to work. Hmm. And that, you know, we shut it down. And I still think it's great stuff, and I still wear it, and I still got some stuff in packaging that I'm just slowly parsing out to myself.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, it's a bummer. You know, things happen. But I think it was all learning, and I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I had the experience. And I'm glad I got to go back into some of the tip of the spear retailers out there and know that we put our stuff on some pro athletes and some of the finest, you know, men in uniform, and it was nothing but positives on that
right.
side.
Right. Well, if you light it up again, call me, I'm in.
Yeah.
So the last thing I wanted to talk to you about, which I actually think is the most interesting, was your decision to move from Orange County to Boise. You had a beautiful place in Orange County. I would say, generally speaking, in this country, that's the you've made it neighborhood and the lifestyle, right? And you can ride your beach cruiser down to PCH and get a coffee and go to the gym and chill, and everything's calm and happy and warm. And you moved to Boise and got a bunch of goats and chickens with three little kids and a wife. Why?
I think that, you know, I really try to, life's an adventure, you know, life's not a straight line. Mm-hmm. Life is winding paths. And, I was doing that. I was on the cruiser, you know, getting coffee and, you know, going and road riding with a group in the morning and reading the paper and that's super. To me though, that is ultimately unfulfilling and boring and a slow death. And I wanted to, again, as we've sort of discussed in this sort of uncomfortable path, go and really discover more of who I was. In addition to that, wanted to show my kids a bit of a throwback life, as opposed to life sort of in Orange County. And so by sort of presenting a different lens to them and a different viewpoint, and I was also terrified that was going to backfire. So But I figured it was worth the risk because we could always go back to Orange County. That was like, we'd have these conversations and we'd spin, my wife and I, and we'd be like, well, what's the worst thing would happen? We just move back here.
That's what I was going to say is like, I talked to so many people, you know, just, I've had a lot of entrepreneurial type things and going to Iraq a bunch and people, I was like, aren't you afraid? Or like, what if it didn't work? I'm like, I always go back to what's the worst that could happen. And most times it's not that bad.
Right.
It might be a little bruise. Pick yourself up. You go on. You have an amazing experience that makes you stronger the next time. But that's a perspective not a lot of people have anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's a bit crazy and certainly out of the box, I think, to go from where we were to buying a hobby farm. And we got immediately into raising animals and we didn't. You know, we just YouTube, like, how do you raise a goat? Like, I don't know.
Is there a video on how to raise a goat on YouTube?
There you would be amazed.
No, I know. It's
the goat knowledge out there. But yeah, so doing that and like, you know, having our kids be a part of that farming experience and getting their hands dirty, and really kind of exposing them to, I don't call that hard work, but it's,
real.
It's real. Yeah.
It's dirt. I mean, I'm a huge fan of this. Being a kid that grew up on a farm and that whole thing, I meet kids who haven't had that experience. And while it was hard, I didn't get to play Little League. I had to bale hay. I look back now and I'm like, man, I'm really thankful because it shaped me a different way.
Yeah.
What are the changes you've seen in your kids since moving? Or in your family, I should say.
I definitely think they never really were. They were kind of getting into that age, the formative years where vanity and labels and some of the, you know, social media stuff is starting to kind of come into play. But I think, you know, they're definitely more inclined to be outside. You know, this is our first exposure to true weather. And like, you know, to play catch with my son when it's 35, 40, like my hand is cold and I'm looking at him like, and I'm thinking to myself, I kind of want to go inside right now.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say anything. But and just so seeing like their little toughness come out and like they have taken so well to not only sort of life on the farm and, you know, we're out there. We're not in a community where you can go next door to Joey's house and ride your scooter. Like that's the next house is pretty far away. Mm-hmm. And the kids are spread. And so to see their sort of self-reliance and, you know, their resiliency to make new friends was really like heartwarming for me and like a really huge positive. Cause honestly, again, I moved out there for a lot of selfish motivation, which was to challenge and test myself and see how I would do, in the solitude. But we've all done pretty well so far.
It seems like you're loving it.
Yeah.
And is it just a clarity? I'll just speak my own personal experience. I had a hard time living in Venice and Orange County with understanding why certain things were important to certain people, like getting a table at the new restaurant or whatever it was. Like, it's a different culture. And me being from a farm in Wisconsin, it was like, I'd rather pound a Cliff Bar and go hike up a hill. And they'd probably look at me the same way and be like, I don't get why you do that.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like clarity is a word I think about when I think about nature and space, and there's just less stuff coming at you. And I feel like, you know, like when I go on these hunts, I feel alive, man. It's like, yeah. I smell more, I see more, I hear more, I sleep better. Yeah. And that leads to a lot of positivity.
Yeah, man. I wake up, I look at my view is trees and mountains,
mm-hmm.
and grass and fields and horses and cows and yes, I think that all has a deep effect, maybe to the core of going back to like, you know, early human instead of this sort of concrete jungle that we've formed and created and manifested and put up all these sort of, you know, barriers and unnecessary stresses. I don't feel I have those kinds of stress. They're gone. They melted away.
Mm-hmm.
They literally melted away. And it's been a very freeing experience. And then the types of people that are moving there are like-minded. So now you have this sort of communal thing and like you meet someone and you're like, God, you're my people.
Yeah.
And it's not where I came from, where it might be like, well, what country club do you belong to? And I'm not trying to hate, like, California's awesome. Let's be honest, guys. But I'm just saying, like,
right.
The whole social dynamic is shifted. And I think it's a more genuine approach, human to human. It's not like I look at you and I go, well, oh, I know this guy. What can he do for me now? It's not like that. Mm-hmm. Other than maybe, can he sell me some hay? Like, I don't know. Like, that's kind of where I am now. But
so, I got a guy if he needs some hay.
Yeah.
But so I've had the same experience, though, here. I find myself around, I don't know, I don't want to even call it type A, but I call it people that are getting outside the comfort zones, people that are elite athletes, Olympians, or entrepreneurs. And they're all kind of in that mindset where it's like, they work hard, they play hard, they're honest people, they reach out to help instead of when they need something. And it's just, they're my people too. Like, I've really found that here more than anywhere else I've lived. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, this is a great spot you got here too.
Well, I'm saying that being like, I think it's the same type of people.
Yeah, for sure.
Boise and Park City or, you know, tomato, tomato, I kind of think.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I don't, you know, I look back obviously with incredible memories and I certainly left some really great people behind that I still, you know, admire greatly and we try to connect and do things. But I'm very grateful that we did leap and that ultimately we have been thriving there and have adjusted to an entirely new lifestyle. And, you know, I'm already even thinking, you know, as time goes on, I'm liking it so much that I could see myself going almost not hermit, but like going deeper, like even once the kids are gone, you know, maybe kind of doing the farm thing and being out even a little more rural than we are.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see.
Just promise me you'll never get anything you have to milk 3 times a day.
Yeah, no, loud and clear, dude. I hear you. I'm not doing it. Not doing it.
Like, it's 20 below zero. You still got to milk that cow. Like, beef cattle, cool. You know? I mean, I would love to have like an elk farm someday or buffalo or.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty rad, right? Like, have a couple thousand acres and ride around some horses. And like, that is fun. There's something in our DNA that like, that just feels good. Right.
It does. I feel that when I walk around out there for sure.
Yeah. I just got to tell you how proud I was to see you pull in a Raptor and not the Land Rover.
Like, yeah.
To me, that's like, all right, my people here.
Yeah. Full shift, man. Yeah.
I love it. So last thing I want to touch on, you've got a podcast. I've been on it. I listened to all the episodes. They're great. Can you tell us a little bit about that and where people can find it? And kind of follow along with what you're up to?
Sure, yeah. So it's called Brevity Code, Brevity Code with Ryan Hauser. We're on iTunes, and you could look up the website. We're at Brevity Code Show on Instagram. You can see all the episode headers there. And literally, it's a, you know, scratching my own itch, total selfish interest kind of thing. You know, having 20 years of apparel experience and having exposure to... Well,
next one's here.
Having exposure to some of the people and some of the brands and places I've been, you know, just wanting to grab some of those people and share their stories. And ultimately, it's about learning. It's a tool for young budding entrepreneurs or philanthropists to go learn about someone else that's been ultimately successful by doing something in a very unconventional way. And so it's really just to give back. It's a total fun thing. I get a total kick out of doing it. And I hope that people are into what I'm putting out.
Yeah. It's awesome, man. I love it.
Cool.
Great stories, good times. I think that's a wrap. We got to roll. But that was perfect timing. Ryan, thanks for being up here, man. More to come.
Christian, thank really you for having me. It. Awesome, dude.
Thanks. Later. Bye.
Despite having massively different lives and upbringings, Ryan and I have always had a lot in common. It wasn't until he sat down today and talked about pushing his comfort zones that I realized that was where our similarities truly stem from. I'm so proud to call this guy a friend and mentor and watch his family's new life evolve in Boise. And stay tuned, there may be more coming soon between Ryan and I. But for now, that's it. We'll see you next time. Thanks, guys.